cataractcoach.com. Welcome to our podcast, episode number 15 today, with Dr. Bill Socha. So Bill Socha is an ophthalmologist in Florida, very high volume surgeon, does many times as much surgery as I do. He's really an incredible surgical machine. But there's more. The mind, body, soul connection, he gets it, he understands it. What does it take to keep the body performing at the optimal level so you can deliver the best surgery for your patients? We talk about a lot of things. Nutrition, hot and cold therapy, cold plunge, saunas. There's a lot of great actual science behind it. Talk about fitness. We even talk about this. You know what that is? You got to listen to the podcast. I'll explain everything, I promise. Really informative. I learned so much. I made a whole page of notes from our podcast of things that I want to do and learn to be a better surgeon and have a better performance and better enjoyment of my own life. Check it out. I want to welcome you guys to our Cataract Coach podcast. And this time we have a special treat. We have Dr. Bill Socha from Florida, who's a very high volume surgeon, and he has a keen insight into the mind-body connection, how your mental and physical well-being affects your performance as a surgeon. So I bet today's topic will give you a few pearls that you can take back to your own clinic and your own operating room, and it'll make you a better surgeon. So Bill, thank you for doing this and welcome.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, it's just an absolute honor to be on this in this podcast. And, you know, I'm a big fan of yours. I have been for years. And a lot of what we'll be getting into are talking about fundamentals. And I'm a huge believer in that. And I think that's what I love about you. Every single day, you can have incredible videos from incredible surgeons all across the country, but you always focus on the fundamentals. And I think that's what we'll be talking a lot today about in our podcast, about, you know, when we talk about our body, we talk about our mind, our spirit. You know, I could talk about so many different areas and speak for hours and go down all sorts of rabbit holes, but we're going to stick to the fundamentals and maybe throw in a few fun hacks.
That'll be fun. And we have no rush. We can take as long as we need to take. But I want to kind of go into a little bit more detail about your background. So you have an unusual background. Most surgeons in your residency, if you can do 200 cataracts in that 1 year, you're like, wow, that's a lot. But then you don't realize you get into practice. There are many surgeons like you who you can do 200 cataracts in a week or two. So tell me a little bit more about your background, how you got into ophthalmology, and what your current situation is in your practice.
Well, I think it'd be a little remiss if I didn't go back a little before that. It was,
sure.
I actually never thought I'd be a doctor, even though I do have a father and an uncle who are doctors. So I always had a tremendous respect for them. But we had an interesting Italian family where half were sort of cops, firefighters, and people getting in trouble, and the other half who were more the intellectual. And I was sort of in the trouble side of things. So, you know, because of a persistent father, you know, I studied against my will. I really didn't care about school. But I was very involved in athletics, which is a big important part of what we're going to be talking about here. But I was an undersized athlete. So I had to figure out ways as a 5'2", 130-pound kid to become a linebacker in high school.
Wow, that's a no small task.
So things started at that point and, you know, in the physical fitness. But long story short, I wound up getting recruited to play football at West Point. And I played football there, and I had an opportunity to be in the military. And I was like, this is it. This is what I'd be doing the rest of my life. And I always kind of kept the medicine thing in the back of my mind. But I served in the first Persian Gulf War in 1990-91. I was a platoon leader for a field artillery battery. And it was interesting because I was in that sort of Soviet era, you know, and fighting the Cold War and that whole thing. And at the end of Desert Storm, which we accomplished in less than 100 hours, defeating the third largest army in the world. The year before, you know, the wall had fell down, you know, between East and West Germany. And I kind of looked at it and I said, wow, what role is for the warrior if there's never going to be a war again? You know, not that we ever wanted war, but, you know, sort of looking at what am I going to be doing for the next number of years of my life. And I was sitting on top of a tank and, you know, our position right before heading home in Iraq, you know, at the beginnings of civilization at the intersection of the Tigris and Euphrates River. And I said to myself, you know what? When I get home, I'm going to go to medical school.
That's awesome. That's fantastic.
So anyway, it's fast forwarding up until about the last year in medical school. I was pretty certain I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon doing research in that area. And this is a really cool story. As I met an eye surgery resident at University of Florida who really impressed with, and he goes, you know, you got a guy from where you're from in that area, Sarasota, you know, that does this really incredible cataract surgeon. His name is David Shoemaker, you know, founder of Center for Sight USI, and I believe done more cataract surgeries than anybody in the world. And I actually know David since I was a kid.
And, wow, small world.
Yeah, so I spent a day with him and said, yeah, why not? I brought this ophthalmology resident down, and I was just so impressed with cataract surgery. I couldn't believe what he was doing and the time he was doing it with. And this is, mind you, back in 1996, going back that far. And we saw patients in the clinic afterwards, and I saw how good they were doing in such a short period of time. So he calls my dad. He was friends with my dad, who was chief of surgery at the hospital, and he goes, yeah. He goes, Bill's going to go into ophthalmology. He's going to be a cataract surgeon, and he's going to work for me someday. And it came all true.
So funny. That's amazing. So, yeah, because I would have pegged you as ortho, because you're very athletic, you played football, you served in the war, so obviously there's a lot of orthopedic injuries there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and I personally broke about every bone, pulled every muscle. So, you know, I was like, yeah, this is it. You know, so no, but after spending that day with him, he was right. It was just the most amazing thing. And anyway, then I did a lot of research and I got my way to what probably was one of the other just great moments of my life. You know, I look at my wife, the birth of my children, you know, my med school education, West Point, and then my residency and fellowship at the Moran Eye Center with, you know, friends of one of your good mentors and friends, Bobby Osher.
Sure.
It was Alan Crandall, who I got to work under.
And wow. Alan Crandall. What an incredible man.
Yeah. God bless his soul, you know, just a fantastic person and surgeon and everything. And interestingly, my last year in residency was the fellowship year of Ike Ahmed, who became really close friends with.
Sure.
And him and I and Alan went to Africa doing a cataract surgery mission. And so talk about fundamentals. And I was, you know, here we are, you know, bringing the portable, you know, phaco unit, loads of ICG and, you know, and Vision Blue. And we had to actually tape flashlights onto microscopes to get coaxial lighting. So,
oh wow, that's so great. Yes. So the toughest cataracts win the toughest conditions.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one thing to do a tough cataract in our fancy operating room with $1 million of equipment. It's another thing to do it in some random place.
Right, right. Which I think speaks to a lot of what we're going to talk about with mind body, and what I love so much about you, because even when you have these incredible cases and, you know, little idiosyncrasies of things, it starts with the draping. You talk about that in every case, you know, then constructing a perfect wound, a perfect rexus, because, you know, as we learned in our training, you know, it's the domino effect. If you don't do those things perfectly, everything goes downhill from there. So I was literally talking to my wife about this a little before I started. I said, it just brings me back to the days of football, and I just couldn't believe the coach. I mean, we're all beaten up and we're running this play again the thousandth time. It's like, why are we doing this? You know, and it was always about, look, you can do what we talked about in football, and it's also a terminology used in poker. It's called FPS, and you could probably apply it to cataract surgery. Fancy play syndrome. You know, I'm going to chop this with this fancy instrument and do this and do that. You know, but at the end of the day, you know, football is about blocking,
the basics,
tackling, you know, and being disciplined. In cataract surgery, it's about doing things, you know, in a fundamental, very systematic manner. And you don't need the fanciest scopes and the fanciest machines and choppers. You know, what you need are really good skills and to be very disciplined and to do it time and time again.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned that. I had a video on cataract coach maybe 2-3 years ago where I said, what's more important, the machines or your hands? And this was a clinic where I was doing some cherry surgery here in LA, and I had they had a Zeiss microscope, and it said on it, made in West Germany. And I'm like, hi, that's 1989 or before. So I'm using a microscope that at the time was 30 years old. It was not the rate limiting step. We could still do the case pretty well.
Right, right. And by the way, that's the scopes we still use.
It's just not the rate limiting step. You know, we get fancier and fancier equipment. But yeah, you're right. At the end of the line, end of the road, it's all about what are the basics.
That's exactly correct.
Yeah. And people always ask, well, what instrument do you use? What chopper do you use? It doesn't really matter. You can even a chopper. I'll still chop the cataract.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I think I first learned that when I was pretty good friends with here in Sarasota, probably also well-known person to you as well, Harry Grable. You know, I remember asking him. I saw that he had some capsular rexus forceps. And so I got in touch with him. I said, Harry, I said, you know, so tell me about your capsular rexus forceps. And he goes, oh, I didn't realize I had a pair after me. So obviously, you know, no, it's definitely not the instrument. It's clearly the surgeon.
So tell me about your practice now. You do a very high volume of surgery as well, certainly much more than I do.
Well, yes, the Center for Sight, you know, a vertically integrated practice, now part of a larger group, USI. You know, and at our center, we do approximately 7,000 IOLs a year, and that's between five of us surgeons altogether. Myself, I probably do between 2,200 cataracts, usually about 60 cases a week, operate 2 half-days a week. So usually do the 30 cases somewhere between 7:30 in the morning, 11:30, that sort of,
is around that time. So 30 cases in about 4-ish hours. Is that with one OR or 2 ORs or three?
That's with two ORs, yeah.
So that's still a pretty good clip. That's a really good clip.
Yeah, it's a good mix. You know, we do have probably in that about when we talk about adoption rates or conversion rates, we're about 40% to 50% of the patients, they choose, you know, having some upgrade where they have, you know, an astigmatic correction, toric IOL, the multifocal lenses, et cetera. And, you know, but you do get my fair number of cases thrown in there. The reason why I mention that is I do get those fair number of cases thrown in there. The rock, the cataracts, I do a lot of the VA cataracts. And also, I like that. I mean, I like having the mix, you know, doing the refractive cases, but also doing some of the most challenging cases, white cataracts, et cetera. So it's a great system. You know, it's the type of practice where, you know, if you want to do a lot of surgery and work with a lot of optometrists, and our optometrists are just absolutely amazing that work at our practice, it's the right place to be.
Well, it sounds amazing. So when you go to what's your preparation? Going to the OR, you got a big day coming ahead of you. In 4 hours, you're going to do about 30-ish cases. That's a pretty good clip. Let's say 7-8 cataracts in an hour between your rooms. You're not wasting any time.
That's correct.
So how do you get in the correct mindset or mind frame, and what's important to you? Do you get there early? Like, I'm so crazy. I get to the operating room 45 minutes or an hour before my scheduled cut time, just so I can get things set up, I can relax, I can just like...
I'll start it where, you know, I do start my cases at 7:30, and I usually do get to the center, to my office, usually by around 6:45. So I'm there about a good 45 minutes. You never know if there's going to be traffic, something happens, and that's in your mind, and that's probably starting the night before. So just doing everything, you know, at West Point, you know, in engineering, which is a primary engineering school, they always talk about Six Sigma. You know, that's doing everything that you can, you know, possible to make sure that everything goes well. And I think that's a perfect way to think of things as a surgeon. You know, you have everything set up from making sure you get there plenty early to you pop into the ORs, making sure all the settings are right. You know, if there's a piece of equipment that's down or, you know, whatever, just making sure everything is super organized that way. But actually, I've always been a super early bird. It goes back to all those years back with playing football and having to live an hour away from school and getting a ride, et cetera. So I've always been used to getting up very early in the military life, et cetera. So I get up most mornings at about 3:30 a.m.
Wow, and that beats me. My normal is usually 4 or 4:30. So what do you do at 3:30 in the morning?
Yeah, well, I usually start off, you know, I kick on the, you know, the black organic mycotoxin-free coffee.
Yeah.
Get that brewing. And I usually bring a cup. I go up to my office upstairs. And I usually spend the first 20, 30 minutes in some form of meditation, prayer, gratitude, that sort of thing. And it just gets the mind spirit sort of right. And then on days that I'm operating, I'm not usually working out very hard, but I do go through a routine of utilizing, and this sort of gets into a little bit advanced stuff, but I actually am standing on a grounding mat where I spend about 10-15 minutes where I'm continuing my prayer, where I'm stacking, you know, making max use of the time.
Sure.
Stacking some stretches in front of red light panels where I'm getting near infrared light, red light.
Sure.
And going through that, then I usually go through some, maybe in about another 10 minutes or so of yoga stretches. Then I actually sit in an infrared sauna that I kicked on about 35 minutes prior to that, we get it up to about 160 degrees. And I'm in there for about 20 minutes, during which time I'm actually going through breathing exercises. So you might have heard of Wim Hof breathing, basically where you're almost building an alkalosis, where you're doing these increasing breath holds and just amazing clearing of your mind and just how good your whole body feels. And then I actually finish off where I have a cold tub, where I have set
at 51 degrees. Oh, cold plunge. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I jump into the cold plunge where I'm actually doing some you know, continuing, not doing any of the breath holds, obviously, I wouldn't recommend that, you know, but doing some deep breathing while I'm, you know, again, concentrating, and, you know, you get out of that thing and the dopamine levels are up and you just...
So how long are you in your cold plunge? So 51 degrees Fahrenheit, so maybe about 10-ish degrees Celsius. How long are you in there for?
Right. I'm usually in 2 minutes, you know. So okay. Sometimes I'll go longer, sometimes I'll go shorter. You can get benefits from a cold plunge in 10 seconds. You know, again, it's just different what you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, different days during the week, that's my typical OR days, you know, the other days during the week, I usually do a couple, 2 to 3 days of pretty hard resistance training. A lot of people will break things down into, like, they'll talk about cardio, but if you're really optimizing your workout, and again, I'm always looking for max efficiency of time, I can probably in a 25 to 30 minute period get a very high intensity type workout where I'm getting strength training. And if, you know, I wear, like I have a device here called an Oura Ring, or it's called Whoop Straps, different things you can do to, like, look at your heart rate. And the whole time during a 25 to maximum 40 minute workout, my heart rate's at a cardio level. So I've even tested myself where it's like, I haven't run, you know, just go out and go for a quote unquote jog. I'll sometimes go to a hill and, like, do sprints up a hill, walk down, sprints up a hill. It's different. That's what we refer to as a high intensity type of workout. But I'll never go for a run. And the last time I think I did it, I decided, well, you know, I'm going to test myself. I haven't run forever, so I'm just going to go stretch and go see how fast I can run a mile in. And I'm still running a mile under 6:30. And
never, wow, that's really fast.
Yeah. Without ever running, as a 57-year-old dude, not too bad.
Yeah, well, it's funny saying that. So yeah, I'm wearing my Apple Watch too. So when I worked yesterday, yeah. I did bench press, and yeah, my heart rate gets to 150 to 160 during an intense set of bench press.
Correct. And if you're then stacking it, like, so for example, you're doing that's a push exercise. So then if you then go to do some sort of a pull exercise, like a deadlift or an upright row, I tend to stack my workouts like that, do a push, then a pull, because that way I can just keep going in between sets. Sure. So I take very minimal rest, so that really you'll notice that the whole time, like you said, when you're doing the set, maybe your heart rate is getting up to that more even anaerobic level. But in your rest cycles, you're not resting long enough that your heart rate ever drops below
right.
the 40 to 60% of your target heart rate, which is considered the cardio. So technically, when people talk about, oh, I'm doing cardio, well, if you're doing your workouts right, you are getting your cardio while you're getting your strength training and getting your anaerobic exercise as well. So those are the little things to learn that, you know, a lot of people think you have to go to a gym and you have to spend hours a day and multiple times a week. And I probably do, like I said, resistance training a couple days a week, some stretching, you know, walking movement, you know, a couple other days
a
week.
Sure.
And then I told you my pre-OR day, you know, routine sort of.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting too is the hot and cold. Like, obviously,
yes.
the sauna is very popular in Scandinavian countries. If you visited
Scandinavian
countries, it's super popular.
That's
and
right.
then also, there's some actual really great studies now that show the benefits of that. And then especially when you combine it with cold plunge, in terms of not only overall health, but even longevity.
That's right. Actually, the Finnish studies, you're absolutely right. Probably the most and best studied, you know, of anything are using saunas, you know, because everybody in Finland has to have a sauna.
Yes.
It's freezing cold. And they showed that if you did it... up to 3 to 4 days a week, that all causes of morbidity and mortality are reduced. And if you do it for 20 minutes, 5 to 6 days a week, it's like a 40 to 60% reduction in all causes of morbidity and mortality. So pretty amazing. And I think with a lot of these things like saunas, breath work, now cold plunge, the beautiful thing about what's happening in today's day and age is that a lot of these things that used to be oftentimes in our field of allopathic medicine talked about as quote unquote quackery, you know, we're now learning that these things have worked, you know, and now we're trying to figure out why, and we're figuring it out. Like with, the sauna, for example, we understand about heat shock proteins.
Yeah,
and how it's actually helping to refold DNA, increase telomere length. And you can see these direct links and study them scientifically and see what happens. Wim Hof, he's got some of the most amazing, this guy is a crazy guy. They call him the Iceman. He's a Scandinavian guy himself who's shown that, you know, when he does these cold plunges over time, how he's actually able to, he did these crazy experiments where he even injected an endotoxin in himself and shows how he doesn't have any of the effects from the endotoxin because
wow.
of what he's been able to do through his breath work and the cold
yeah,
training.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. And just like there's heat shock proteins, with the cold, there's cold shock proteins, and not to mention increase in dopamine levels
sure,
and all the other benefits that occur, neurogenesis, et cetera.
Then you must sleep early then. Don't tell me you're one of those guys who can get 4 hours of sleep. I'll feel so jealous because I need a solid like 7 to 8 hours.
No, I'm so glad you said that because it actually re-centered me here in this conversation, because already I might have lost a bunch of people that said, oh God, okay, this guy's nuts. We got, you know, we're never going to do this. No, because again, you know, let's start with the fundamentals. We talked a little bit about exercise. I mean, I think if even you just get outside, natural vitamin D, a little grounding, move, you know, do some walking, maybe do some resistance
training. Hey, speaking in an ophthalmology now, we know for kids, an hour a day outdoors lessens your risk of myopia. Proven.
Exactly. And again, you know, you talk about like, you know, taking off the shoes and putting your feet in the ground, and people talk about grounding. Again, we understand the science behind that. It has to do with the electrostatic charges that our body naturally is positive. You know, we talk about, reactions that go on our body, like when we're sick, you know, those are actually literally electrostatic forces that counterbalance. But to answer your question about the sleep, no, that goes back to the fundamentals. I would say maybe the most important thing, you know, is getting sleep. And I sleep definitely. I try to get a good 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night. And, you know, we talk about sleep hygiene, getting yourself prepared for sleep. So like when you and I, when we have a couple times, we have some podcasts and all, and I say the podcast going on at 9 p.m. like, sorry, guys, can't make it.
Yeah, you got to go get to bed.
When I'm not on call or I have something important going on at night, I usually turn my phone off. Television lights, try to have everything off. Just have a little bit of natural light in the room, you know, where we read a book, you know, make sure all the electronics, Wi-Fi is off, that whole stuff, you know, to maximize the environment, you know, a good hour or so before. You know, I try not to, like with my eating, it could be, you know, we talk about nutrition, which is a big part of it. Again, you know, we talk about really good sleep, exercise, you know, nutrition. You know, one of the things that I would encourage so many people, if they want to talk about maximizing their physical fitness, mental fitness, et cetera, is of course their nutrition. And I think if you ask me what's a good place to start, I would say, you know what, if you eat 2 bags of Doritos and drink a 6-pack of Coke and another 6-pack of beer and 3 candy bars, and that was your diet, and you're doing that from 6 a.m. till about 6 p.m., the first thing you should do is take that window of 12 hours and compress it into 6 to 8. Still eat the crap, whatever it is you're eating or drinking, but do it in that window.
So like intermittent fasting or timed eating.
Correct. Time-restricted eating. That's critical. And I know a lot of people will go back and forth. And I think any form of time-restricted eating is good, meaning, you know, maybe you skip the morning meal and you stack your eating in the latter part of the day. I try to do the opposite. One, based on the schedule. And two, clearly it's been shown. They even say, like with Alzheimer's patients, that they should try not to eat anything a minimum of 6 hours before they go to bed at night. Mm. So I try to compress that window to make sure I'm not eating somewhere between 5 to 6 hours optimally. Sometimes it's hard though. You come home, you want to have something to eat, et cetera. So it's very difficult, particularly with all of our schedules. But the longer you can make that window before you eat, the better. And I would try to advise a good at least 3, if not 4 hours of time, you know, that you're not eating before you go to bed, because it's going to help you to sleep better. And again, you can track that with devices. Like when I eat later, God forbid I have a glass of wine or something like that, you just see the sleep scores plummet and then your readiness scores plummet. The Oura Ring that I wear gives not only a score, it tells me how well I slept, it gives me a readiness score because it measures my resting heart rate.
Sure.
It measures my body temperature. And then of course it measures the different stages of sleep, like your REM sleep, your deep sleep, your latency, that means your time to fall asleep, all of these things, and it gives you a sleep score. And then again, based on those other factors, your heart rate, et cetera, gives you a readiness score. So it's really cool. So when I have a weekend and I'm out really late, I just take the ring off that night.
So you don't want to save the bad data.
Yeah, occasionally I do that. I shouldn't though. You're right.
So you're eating right. You sleep real well. You obviously exercise. You get to the surgery center. So like me, I do a lot of prep ahead of time. I'm also really concerned with video. So I always clean my optics, do a white balance, make sure the camera's focused sharply, et cetera. Right. Now, tell me about doing the cases, like the mindset. You start off in this case. Do you book your case in any particular order? Your staff books them for you? Do you like the easy ones first and the hard ones? Do you do all right eyes and all left eyes? Is it all mixed? Kind of what's it like?
I, I used to stack. I used to be the guy that, like, you know, I'm going to put my, if I have some really difficult cases, put them at the end. Now I just throw them in whatever makes most sense, you know, for the patients in terms of their scheduling. And, you know, and I'd really not too concerned which one is first or second or last. But I would basically advise, I definitely felt more comfortable early on, you know, like stacking my more difficult cases, you know, toward the end of my day. And you know, some people say, you know what, I want to get my most difficult ones done first. So I think there's good rationale to those types of things. And I guess I would answer that by simply saying, do whatever's, you know, makes you feel most comfortable. You know, yeah. Again, for me, I'm now at a phase where, you know, bring it, whatever's there is there.
Yeah. But, so I do the same thing. I have my staff book, I'm kind of in any order. But what I do is I tell them, if it's a particularly tough case, I see a patient with like a clearly visible dislocated crystalline lens, I tell my staff, book it if you want, but book it for two slots in my schedule.
Right, right.
So that way, even if I finish early, then at least I'm not stressed out that every other patient's waiting.
No, you're absolutely right. And if I do have a really particularly unusual case like that, the, you know, three zonules, you know, white cataract, 5+ NS, yeah, I'm definitely still going to put that person like right at the end so that I like, okay, that this is it. I don't have anything else to focus on except that. You know, that's definitely good advice, no question.
How do you keep your mindset? So you're going from patient to patient. I know you, like me, have the philosophy that you give every patient the highest level of care. You give the treatment that you'd want to receive. You know, the golden rule we learned in kindergarten. How do you keep that mindset with 30 patients in a row and going from room to room? What's the key to your focus there?
You know, I think that's where, you know, I talked a lot already about the body and kind of touched into somewhat of the mind and the focus where, you know, the breathing came in. But I started off, you know, with, like I said, where the absolute first thing I do is my meditation, my prayer. And when I get to work after I've done all that and I'm already sort of super focused and feeling really good as I'm checking the OR, I'm back in my office for about another 5 minutes where I do just have a little yoga mat. I do another little stretch or two. And I pray again. And I sit there and I say, you know, I'm Christian. And I know everyone has different faiths that are listening to this. Some not, maybe not any at all, you know, but I pray. And I just with gratitude, how grateful I am, you know, to sure. God to have given me the training that I have and the ability to be entrusted to take care of these wonderful people. And, you know, I say, guide my hands. And, you know, it's just like that just gets my mind in a perfect focus. And I have a little, you know, prayer that I say between each case and each room. And I'm literally like, I feel like I'm in a constant state of flow. I think we used that terminology the last time we talked.
And
I think that's a body, mind, spirit flow, you know, that, you know, and that's just goes from one to the other. And it's just great. And that's why it's like, I think we talked about, it's our happy place. It's, the best days of the week. And I think that's why surgeons in their own way, whether they have a spirituality or not, you know, maybe don't even realize it, that they have a spirituality, even if they don't realize it.
Yeah, you know, 100% of cataract surgeons I talk to who've done, let's say, 5,000 or more cases, they all mention being in that state of flow where it just seems to just happen. It's such a pleasure.
It really is. Yeah.
Tell me about ergonomics too in the operating room. So obviously you're not hunched over on your microscope in some weird position. How do you set your ergonomics right?
I think that's a great point. And one of the things that, you know, again, back to some of the physical preparation stuff, you know, I do a lot of stretching. I do some yogic type stretching. But there's a wonderful thing, not to go down too many rabbit holes like I promised I would not, but there's a wonderful thing I could recommend to anybody in the world for that matter, but particularly any cataract surgeon, sure. Any eye surgeon. It's something called EGOSQ. EGOSQUE.
I don't know what that is. Say it again. Yeah. EGOSQUE.
EGOSQUE is how you pronounce it. It stands for EGO, like ego, SQUE. Okay. And it's named after Peter EGOSQUE, who developed this sort of body posture type work. And when you think about it, all of us, for some reason or to some extent, have some body posture issues. For example, I tore an ACL skiing in Utah years ago, you know, had surgery, worked real hard to rehab it, but still there's just a little bit of an imbalance. And because I work so hard on physical fitness and I still squat and I do all these different things, I can tell even just the most subtle, even though it's like so tuned up from all the rehab I did, it just created a subtle imbalance, which I think creates a subtle imbalance in one hip.
And
I can feel the effects of the opposite shoulder. So the whole concept behind EGOSQUE is not to okay, we're going to make your knee feel better or this feel better. It's actually a postural analysis. And you look, you can see, wait a minute, one shoulder's tilted a little more to the left or to the right. I'm twisted thoracically, you know, one way to the other a little more. And it puts you through these sets of, let's say, exercises, you know, holds and all that. It's amazing. Literally after doing like two or three of them in like 2 or 3 minutes, I had this person that I literally have to go like twice, and I'm maybe going to go one more time and I don't have to go again. But she took pictures of me like before, 5 minutes later, after doing two or these three things, I go from like being tilted one way to being like perfectly straight. So I do things like that, you know, outside of the operating room to get myself to feel good, to my neck to be loose. But when I actually get in the OR itself, I know, and this goes again, is back to what we were talking about. There are a lot of fancy tools out there, and I'm not seeing anything good, bad, or indifferent, like about these, you know, 3D televisions. You don't even have to be behind a scope because it's better for your ergonomics. And I'm sure there's some merit to that. And maybe one day I'll even try that. And I'd probably be really cool to experience it. But like when I get into the OR, you know, on my chair, I actually try to have my neck in hyperextension, you know, and then I pump up my chair until I just get where I'm like perfectly even. Because I think what the tendency is, and I've watched
to look down a little bit.
Exactly. Is that we get, well, we hunch over, you know, because it's a natural thing when we want to take charge or control, you hunch over something. It's almost like, too, if you look at fighters, I used to box as well. So if you look in other martial arts, if you look at fighters, the natural tendency of fighters is always to lean forward. And you actually wind up shadowing, you know, or kind of almost giving away, telegraphing is the word, excuse me, you know, like telegraphing your punch. And when you watch surgeons, they're telegraphing themselves there. They want to get into that eye. So they're like, they tense up their traps, their necks bent forward. So start off the case, you know, big deep breath. This takes 2 seconds. Pump yourself up. You almost want to like throw your shoulders back and then relax. And then boom, start your case. Yeah.
Well, I have a confession. When I was in my, let's say, late 20s as a resident and 30s, I didn't believe any of this ergonomic stuff. Until now. Now I'm not. When you hit the big 5-0, hit the 50 mark, and 20 years of experience. Now, knock on wood, I don't have any issues, but the number of my fellow colleagues, my age or older, who ophthalmologists who have cervical disc disease or cervical problems from this bad posture, it blows my mind. The number, it's a huge number of ophthalmologists.
Right. I'd obviously not naming any names, but there's a few out there in their 40s who've had some cervical spine fusion already, you know, talking to. So, no, it's a real problem. And I would say for myself, just like you, you know, and you're tough, we're bench pressing.
Right.
We're feeling great. Yeah. Who cares? We're good to go. You know, and then we realize, you know what, I gotta alter my training. I realized that, you know, a key number for me was 44. Not to digress off the subject.
Yeah.
I remember being 44 and coming home from a workout or whatever, my shoulders were really sore and I got into this like funk. I like felt like I do 10 pushups and my shoulders are killing me. And this, you know, I'm used to doing, you know, 102 minutes. And then I started at that point really taking a deep dive and trying to figure out what's going on. And I started learning all these different things about positioning and ergonomics and stretching properly. And, you know, and things like, for example, you're a bit, interestingly about shoulders, you know, they say the number one problem with people's shoulders, what the number one cause of shoulder problems are in the world
is,
you'll laugh, bench press.
Oh, now here's funny you say that. So because of that, to take care of my glenohumeral joint, I actually was wearing this right before our call. Let me just show you. This is literally something that resets the shoulder position for the glenohumeral joint. And I feel like a total dork when I'm wearing it, but boy, it makes me feel much better. And when I was in my 30s or even up to 40-something, I would have never even like thought about doing this. But now after 50, like after bench press, I need this to reset that joint. But yeah,
well, you know, that's beautiful that you got that, because I saw that, you know, just the other day, because, you know, I see this all the time, and I'm sure you do. And I reflect on this when we're looking at patients that are scoliotic or kyphotic.
Yeah,
they don't wake up one day like that, right?
That's slow over the course
20,
of decades.
30, 40 years, right. And it's just we're all naturally, when we're talking, you know, we kind of lean forward, we look into it. I was playing some cards and watching a 20-year-old. He's just kind of hunched over, and I'm thinking, man, that poor guy is going to be 30 with cervical disc disease, right?
Yeah.
You know, so you hit it on the nose. I mean, and having tools like that, that's what I would call like a biohack. You know, I was like, sure. Where you get into doing those things that's properly positioning yourself. But when you think about the bench press, and this is an interesting little thing, you also hear like people, for example, who, oh yeah, I work my abs, you know, 2 times a week, 3 times a week, you know, doing hundreds of sit-ups or whatever. And what's their problem oftentimes? Lower back pain.
Yeah.
Why? You know, why? Because they're doing everything, you know, you think about our muscles and our body, it's a whole system of agonists and antagonists. So you got your tricep is the antagonist to your bicep. And so we're doing everything in our life in athletics. So again, football, you're a linebacker, you're pushing away, you know, push-ups. Even if you're not in competitive sports, you're doing push-ups, you're doing bench press, and you're doing really everything which is internal rotation. And so how many times in the gym do you see people working external rotation, you know, like taking a dumbbell and going backwards, or, you know, going with a band backwards to work those little small muscles around the rotator cuff that are called external rotators? The answer is they're not. Now, you know, so many more of these injuries you see in women that are, you know, that never had shoulder injuries, but you have all these athletes that, what are the lady volleyball players who are spiking balls, and the basketball players, again, all internal rotations. So again, the message to the listeners here is to think about how your body, your posture. That's why I mentioned Egoscue. And if you do work out, that's great. Resistance training, wonderful. I mean, make sure you're doing a very balanced approach where you're working your internal rotators, external rotators, your neck muscles, your traps, you know, and you're stretching, you know, all of these things to kind of make you more complete.
Yeah, that's all so critical. I mean, yeah, as you get older, you know, our machine, our body is so critical to keep it in good functioning form in order to have a long surgical career. Because it's not that's just right. the mind. It's like it's a physical task that we're doing.
That's right. That's right. No, everything. You know, and a lot of times people have problems later on. You know, maybe they're getting some arthritis in their hands. And, you know, and again, that can be affected so much by your diet, even the things that I do. I mean, my wife's always looking at me. She goes, what are you doing? I'll be like sitting on the couch or something like that. And I'm flicking my fingers and, you know, I'm massaging in my joints. I'm, you know, I'm always sitting there like twisting my wrists. And, you know, and I tell you, my wrists, my knuckles, my neck probably are more supple than they were 20, 30 years ago when I was Mr. Tough Guy. You know, yeah, you know, I can, you know, get through all this. I probably in a lot of ways feel better than I ever have in my life. You know,
yeah, me too. Yeah. Different mindset. For me, it means in the gym, I don't bench press above a certain weight. I'm not trying to hit any kind of max anymore. I don't care about that. I was the thinking I had in my 20s and 30s was so different than I think now when it comes to resistance training.
Right. I think we were talking about it. Yeah, no, it's like I was doing a workout with my son-in-laws, you know, both one is an ex-football player, the other one is a soccer player, both in like pristine condition. And, you know, one's 25 and one's 27. They go, yeah, Doc, you want to do a workout with us? You know, down here, run us through a leg workout. I'm like, yeah, sure. So, you know, and they're all, you know, putting on all the extra weight. And I'm just like, nah, you know, I would have probably been worried about adding that extra plate, but not anymore. Although, you know, I said, okay, now before we go to dinner, we're going to do a pull-up contest. So, you know, so old Doc still got him on the pull-ups.
Awesome. Well, you know, one of the things I struggle with too is I can, for me to burn 2,000 calories, let's say 1,000 calories, for me to burn 1,000 calories is 2 hours of intense work.
Right.
For me to
eat
1,000 calories is 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just the imbalance. That's so, like, why do our bodies have to be so efficient extracting calories out of food?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think, you know, and that's where a lot of the whole concept behind intermittent fasting comes in, and, you know, some of the benefits from that, because I think so much of our body, you know, it's really interesting. You hear a lot of in the physical fitness world, and I'd probably say in the mental and even spiritual world, there's a lot of baby talk. And what I mean by that is, like, sometimes you'll get people who will say, oh, you got to eat an all vegetarian diet, or you got to be a vegan. It's the only way to go. And you'll have just as many people, and they'll take out their studies and show you why, that say, you should be, oh, you should be all carnivore diet.
Yeah.
You know, like that. And a lot of it's baby talk, because I think what we're learning is that, you know, one, it's really different from one individual to another.
Sure.
You know, and so much of precision medicine now is being done with some of the stuff you and I talk about a lot with AI. There's actually a company called, I believe it's Amsterdam Genomics, that I had this DNA analysis done. And it could actually show you like different areas, you know, on your DNA, that why you may be better off eating this style of diet versus that style of diet. So I think things are going to learn to be so customized. So that's why when people ask me about nutrition, I say probably the best thing is, you know, again, stick to the fundamentals.
The basics.
That. Yeah. You know, it's like when you're in a grocery store, stay out of the middle aisles, go to the outer aisles, you know, or fruits, veggies, you know, fresh meats, you know, et cetera.
The foods that your grandma would have recognized.
That's right. Stay away from the processed food. Stay away from the sugar. You know, stay away from the, you know, the bad vegetable oils, those kinds of things.
So you're operating on an empty stomach then? Because I do as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I think I'm sharper.
Yeah, no question. Actually, I go into on my operating days, I do a little bit of a longer fast. I typically try to most days except weekends, time restrict eating, you know, I'm in a window of 6 hours or so and 18 off. And then when I actually on my operating days, I'm actually more on a 24 hour. And that's where, in fairness, I'll even cheat. I'll take a little test tube worth of almost of exogenous ketones. You can get them on Amazon, like Ketone 4-8, and HVMN is another great one. And take just a little shot of ketones, as it usually will take your body 2 to 3 days of fasting to get to a level of ketones, which when your body burns ketones, man, your mind is clear. You don't feel hungry. You just feel like you have the energy, ready to conquer the world. And so if you're in a partial fast and you just take a shot of that, you're just like, wow.
I've never even heard of that. That's a very interesting hack.
Yeah. So that's one of those little hacks. Again, I don't like talking too much about hacks because I want to, you know, again, stick to the fundamentals.
Basics.
I don't want to scare people off. But yeah, I think as you get, it's like anything else in life. And once you get into something and you start, you know, it's like surgery. You know, you stick with the fundamentals, you get great. And then you do start doing some of the other, hey, you know what, when I use this particular instrument, it's that much easier, or I really like this for this particular case. It's the little nuances. It's almost like that's the way I think hacks should be used. Unfortunately, our world's different. They're like, okay, I want to eat all this crap, you know, I want to drink this, you know, but I want to lose weight. What pill can I take? Or what vitamin? That's the first question I get asked by people. What vitamins do you take? They don't ask me, how much do you sleep? You know, what do you do with your physical fitness plan? They're like, what vitamins do you take? You know, it's like, okay, that should be like number five question, right?
Yeah, that's like not the basics.
Exactly.
So our basics are, so for surgeon to perform well in the operating room, let's summarize. We're going to do, obviously you want a good night's sleep.
No question.
You don't want a stomach full of food and you go to bed, you're not going to sleep as well. You obviously don't want alcohol the day before or the night before.
Never.
The morning of, just having that clear mind, get a good night's sleep. You go to the surgery center. For you and me, we're going basically fasted. If anything, I don't do the black coffee, but I guess you like a black coffee in the morning to get you going. And then in the surgery center, it's basically just keeping that kind of that focus, getting in that state of flow, that whole mind-body awareness, getting the ergonomics just right. Now, if you're doing all this, what happens when there's a glitch in the system? Like you do a case and like there's some issue. You just realize that you're doing the case, patient had an airbag injury, there's some complication, you have a capsule break. Happens to every surgeon at some point. It can be less than 1 in 1,000, but it happens. How do you refocus, get back on the horse, continue the day? What's your outlook for that? How do you do that?
You know, and I think it takes time, you know, you never like when that happens. I think you have to, you know, finish that case to the best of your ability. Say, okay, you know, this was plan A. It didn't go as expected. You know, I need to get my capsular tension ring. I need to, whatever the case may be, you know, to finish that case with complete focus, not, you know, be in that present moment. I think that's the key answer there is, don't think about, I got this case or that case. No, your total focus has to be on that case. And then when you get into that next case, you know, you take a big, deep breath, you move, and, you know, you're starting again. Now we're on case one. You can't.
You gotta compartmentalize that issue and just
absolutely
move.
Absolutely. You know, and then, you know, like I usually will tell a nurse, usually, you know, because we do most of our optometrists do, you know, our post-operative care and most of the co-management. But like if I have a tough case that goes really well, like, I mean, yesterday I had 30 cases and I had one case that, you know, was small pupil, you know, 4+ NS, you know, and the case went great, you know, right at the very end. I said, you know, there's a little small rent in the posterior capsule. I put a lens in the sulcus, you know, and, you know, no vitreous forward, nothing. Everything was great. I still saw that patient. I was like, I told my nurse, you know, hey, I want to see Mr. Jones, you know, fake name. I want to see Mr. Jones, you know, tomorrow at 2 o'clock at my clinic, you know, again, just so I can just again tell Mr. Jones, hey, put the lens in a slightly different place. Everything was perfect. Patient was like 20/20, you know, doing fantastic. But bottom line, again, that's part of the compartmentalize, you know, have a plan, what you're going to do with the patient afterwards, and then you have to move on to the next one, you know, and then revisit it when your surgery's over, then you do your after action review. That's what we used to call it in the military. I try to do that after every single, operating session. You know, I go, you know, once I've talked to the staff or whatever, I'd gone back to my office and I literally sit down, I look at my surgery schedule and I said, was there something I could have done differently or better in any of the cases?
Wow, even if it's, that's amazing.
Sometimes it's just a minute, you know, that I do that. And so a couple of times, if I had a couple of cases, I was like, hey, was there something different I could have done?
Yeah.
Even write it down so I can go to cataractcoach.com.
But no, this is actually a really important thing. I do the same thing at the end of my surgical day. We're about the same age. I'll sit there and I'll look at my lineup and say, you know what, let's go through these cases. Let me look at some of the videos. I want to watch that one again. How did I do there? And I say, you know, it's good, but I could have done this a little bit differently. I'm still learning tens of thousands of cases later, and I'm sure you are too.
No, absolutely. I mean, number one, I'm still learning all the time. And number two, back to the fundamentals. I didn't tell you this, and it's kind of funny, and I'm, you know, I love you, but, you know, and I'm not trying to give you props, but literally before all my, you know, as part of in my office, I've done all my stuff at home, you know, I've checked everything out in the OR. Now I'm back to my office. I still have 10, 15 minutes where I'm going to do a little breathing, like I talked about, whatever.
Sure.
But all my, and by the way, and again, it's just a psychological thing. All my emails are cleared out. Everything is, so I don't have anything. It's like a mindset, like, okay, all I have to do now, the only thing that matters in life are these cataract surgery cases. Like, I have nothing else on the plate, nothing else to do. So I clear out the emails, but I actually usually look at the cataract coach video of the day or the day before. And I look for more of the basic cases. Just get fundamentals, great draping. It just gets you in that mindset, you know. It's just like, and I'm pumped, and then I storm off.
Well, I watch way more videos than I produce. I watch videos every day.
But
you're right. It's also the reason why I get the videos out. They come out every day at 5 a.m. Eastern. Just in case people are in that zone, they want to check it out, it's available to you.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's just that it's a whole mindset, mind flow, you know. So it's numerous things, and it's just time and focus, and then you know you'll learn your own way. So you know, some of the listeners here might be like, "This guy's nuts." No way. Maybe there's one or two things. You know, maybe we'll try that.
Well, you know, it's interesting though. Things that we thought about a generation ago that seemed nonsensical now they have actual scientific proof. Like you talked about heat shock proteins and doing a sauna.
Right.
People say, "Oh, you're just in the sauna; it just makes you feel better." No, they're actual measurable benefits.
Right. Well, you know, and those yogis doing breath holds for like 6 minutes, some crazy amounts of time. You know, and like, you know, these dudes, you know, they weigh 100 pounds, but they're like, you know, 120 years old.
Yeah, for sure.
And they look great. I mean, you know, so it's like, you know, so people are like, oh, you know, that's quackery. But, you know, these guys have been doing it. Now we understand what's going on with the breathing, you know, why these breathing exercises are so good for you. You know, vasodilatory effects, you know, the metabolic alkalosis the short-term metabolic alkalosis that you create in your body, how good that is in terms of anti-inflammatory, et cetera. So it's like, yeah, again, I can go on so many rabbit holes with so many of these things. I didn't mention to you that you know the track of my life, you know, is okay, so you're an undersized athlete, how do you compete? Now you're in the military, you know, leading troops, so you obviously want to set the example and be the guy that does more push-ups, can run the fastest, and you know, or you do everything you can to be, you know, one of the top, you know, physically fit guys in your unit. And then I go to medical school and I'm just like, I just never stopped. I'm just like, you know, I got to get my run in, I got to get a lift in or whatever. And I always found a way. Usually when I remember having two young kids from fellowship and being post-call or something and, you know, Open Globe or whatever, it's like 36 hours, no sleep. And I'm driving home and I'm like, there was a little gym on the way. I'm just like, I got to stop there and do something because if I don't do it, I'm never going to do it. So I pop one of those energy drinks, you know, like do like a 20-minute workout and go home. I mean, so it's like maybe I did that once, twice a week. Other times, even an internship or whatever, people look at me like, what are you doing? And be on the ground doing push-ups. There's really no excuse is I guess my point. You know, I don't want to hear excuses about I'm too busy, I can't do this, I can't do that. What's important to you in your life
is what you're
going to spend time on.
Yeah, right? For sure.
Bingo.
How has you've done tens of thousands of cases, and you'll likely do in your career maybe even close to 80,000, 100,000 cases. in your tens of thousands of cases, how has your learning curve kind of progressed? What are the important kind of milestones or things you've learned along the way? As in a general sense, a lot of our cataract coach viewers, especially on the podcast, skew younger. So anywhere from mid-20s as a resident to maybe even, you know, 30s and 40s is kind of our primary audience. And they're always wondering, like, gosh, I mean, it seems like cataract surgery is such a struggle now. Because when you're at case 200, you don't realize, like, wait, it's going to be way easier than this. Case 200 is so, so early in the curve. But what's your wisdom for our younger viewers and listeners over tens of thousands of cases about your progression of surgical skills?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, I think, unfortunately, a lot of young folks, they worry about their time, you know, and I think that whether you're an absolute novice surgeon or whether you're a surgeon that's done 40,000 cases, 50,000 cases, you should never be saying, you know, how many cases am I doing in an hour? How fast am I? You should be saying, how efficient am I? You had a great video maybe in the last couple months or so where you were talking about OR, you were focusing on OR efficiency. You know, like someone makes an incision, the incision looks great, and, you know, 5 minutes later, the viscoelastic's going in the eye. It's like, what are you doing? What are you doing, dude? You know, it's like, that's efficiency. You know, but each move you want to, like, focus on doing perfectly. Don't worry about the time. And then you're working with your staff, you know, they're handing off instruments, you know, and you'll get a zone going with your staff. You know, you'll get that whole thing. They'll know when to hand you what stuff. That's efficiency. That's time. So that's number one.
So efficiency improves as you do more and more cases.
That's absolutely right. And number two, I think we just said it a minute ago in this, you know, in the interview here, is that you continue to learn. You continue to improve. You know, it's like, oh, that's really good. I'm going to try that next time. So yeah, I've done now. I was calculating that. Figured you might ask me. I'm between 40 to 50,000 cases right now, and to your point, I'm still learning. So don't ever think that, yeah, when I get to this point, you know, then I'm set and everything is all done. You know, look at it with humility. Every single case is different, and you say that every. I love it too because it's like so many times. You know, like you prepare. What I find funny, and I'd be interested to get your take on this, is that. You're looking in the clinic and you're like, oh boy, looks like there's about 5 zonules. You know, it's a 4+ NS, you know, so, you know, you have everything prepared. That's another key lesson, you know, have some of your micro instruments ready and make sure you tell the staff to be ready, even documented in a chart, possible vitrectomy, whatever the case may be. And it's like 9 times out of 10 and that, in those cases that I prepare for that way, they all go great. And then you have the case that's like, you know, slam dunk, everything's going great. And you look and you're like, well, how the heck did that happen?
Exactly.
Why are those zonules loose over there? Or like, you know, I didn't do anything, I promise. You know, it's like, you know, so so those unexpected things will always occur. And I think it's, I do think there is something to be said about personality types, but I think for most of us, you know, we want to be surgeons, you know, meaning eye surgeons, that we know we're surgical. So we sort of have that bent toward surgery. But, you know, I remember watching, I can't remember which one of the series, because obviously, as you can imagine, as an Italian undersized athlete, you know, one of my heroes of all time is Rocky Balboa, you know. Sure. But I remember Mick, the old coach, always saying, he always, remember, now fear is a good thing, and he called it Frankie fear. You know, so you should always go in with, call it fear, call it humility.
Humility,
you know, always go in there, you know, and having a little bit of those butterflies in your stomach, that's a good thing. You know, for me, that's home. You know, if I don't have a little bit of butterflies in my stomach, I'm yawning, my wife's kicking me. She goes, how do you operate, man? You don't do anything around here.
No, it's like,
everyone talks about how intense you are, you know, yet you're home and you're like a dud, you know.
Because you've already gone through that phase, the high energy phase. So at what point in, so 40, 50,000 cataracts later, at what point did you feel like, wow, okay, I'm up the learning curve? Was it case 500, case 1,000, case 5,000? Because again, we have a lot of younger viewers who are just at the very beginning and that are wondering, like, when am I going to get to that phase of like, yes, it's just I'm in the zone, I'm having a state of flow?
No, I think that's a great question. I think there could also be, you know, like for some docs, if they switch practices or switch places, there could be different inflection points, if you will. And, you know, again, because you'll come, like, for example, like I was really fortunate to, number one, be at a program. That's why I wanted to go to the Moran Center so much. One, the people. And two, because they've always keep the residency number far lower than we could be. We could easily be a 5-resident program out there, and it's still a 2-resident program. So as a result, every resident, even without a fellowship, is coming out with a minimum of 500. And then I stayed on the fellowship and this. I almost came out with close to 1,000 cataracts. So I was very blessed that way to come out that way. So I felt like pretty much like a hotshot. But I would say after getting another 1,000 under my belt, I really felt like I was, okay, I get it. I've seen a lot of, you know, difficult scenarios, one from training and then even in private practice and all. But I would still say, you know, I honestly 100% feel like I am becoming a better surgeon at wherever I am, 45,000, than I was at 40. So I think it continues. It's just because you continue to learn little nuances, and that's where maybe some of the quote unquote FPS does come in, you know, where I can do this little maneuver here and maneuver there.
Yeah.
And I think, again, the thing to focus on so much is focus on the fundamentals. Don't worry about the little fancy stuff. And, you know, but yet, to answer your question directly, I think you get to that 1,000, 2,000 mark, you'll really start feeling, you know, more in the zone and in the groove.
Yeah, it's funny. I came to the same conclusion. I have an old, old video on cataract coach from probably 3-4 years ago where I said, yeah, I'd say 1,000, 2,000 cases is somewhere between 80 to 90% up the learning curve.
Right, right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and then like, you know, I can tell you're the same way. I mean, you know, you're such a humble person. And I think that's the key. It's the key to life. It's the key to progress. And it makes it great. And the other great thing that you did, you know, that I did a bit as a fellow and, you know, with some of the younger surgeons coming in, you know, is training people. I mean, you know, because it's one thing to do it, you know, and to talk about it. And, you know, it's another thing when you have like you're putting the instruments in somebody else's hands, and that's like
literally holding their hands.
No, I made that mistake, you know, because I was a fellow at the Moran too, so I knew all the residents and was close friends. I go, oh yeah, you know, if some of the attendings are, you know, being lazy, whatever, if you want to call me in on the open globes, just call me. I mean, I'm there for you anytime. So they took me up on that every single night.
Well, and if people don't know that's like a center that draws from multiple states.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was just like, how in the world? There's no place you're close to South Dakota than Utah.
But that's, of course, amazing training. But yeah, that is very humbling. Teaching is a whole nother ball of wax, as they say.
Absolutely. No question.
But yeah, I retired from that last year. After 22 years of doing it, I estimate about 10,000 cases I attended for residents.
Wow.
So it's a pretty good clip here.
I think that's those couple gray hairs, right?
Yeah, more than just a couple here. But I think, you know, we're having an incredible field that we're in. And I think I want to do this podcast so badly because to focus on performance. And performance in the OR is not just a skill that you learn mentally. It's not just your dexterity in your hand. It's the whole mind, body, soul. It's kind of everything together.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think it is. And, you know, one of the things I didn't touch into, and it would probably get a little short on time, but, you know, I'm also a deacon in my church. So, you know, I really take that part of it. And even when I'm talking to people at church about more spiritual matters, you know, I you know, they're talking about their sleep. And I always inevitably wind up getting into the conversation about, you know, maybe what they're eating and, you know, try to help them with their sleep and, you know, get outside, you know, get some sunshine, you know, get a walk. You know, so I just think in everything, you know, combining those three things, I kind of look at it as like a stool, right? With three legs. One of those legs is broken, you're going to be wobbling.
Yeah.
And I think that's in everything. And if I can get a message out to anybody about anything, number one, what's important you're going to spend time on, you know, I don't care, you know, your relationships, you know, with your loved ones, your physical fitness, whatever it is, you know, you have to put time into it. And, you know, when you think you've got it all, you know, it's like, I've got it all figured out. You know, that's where I think we'll start running into problems.
Right. Right. When you get too proud there.
That's right.
You got to stay a little more humble. I mean, another important lesson I say is, you know, you see a patient, like I had this with a resident once, you see a patient coming in and their first eye clearly had some surgical issues during the cataract surgery. They got a sulcus lens there, a little bit of iatrogenic iris damage. The eye still doesn't look great, but the patient sees okay out of it. The danger is to think, oh, well, I'll do a better job for the second eye. The danger is to be a little too proud and a little too confident in your skills, because you're not giving the first surgeon the benefit of the doubt. And second, you're not understanding that the patient's got some protoplasm or some tissue that's going to humble you in a second.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. No. So, I mean, I think that humility, the other thing I think too, you know, just getting in that right mind spirit, you know, is that, you know, that of gratitude, you know, whether, you're like me, where your gratitude does go to, you know, to God, you know, and even if you don't believe in God, you know, having gratitude, it's amazing just how good you feel. There's actually numerous studies, you know, for all us doctors here on gratitude practice, you know, gratitude journaling, you know, it's like, man, I'm so grateful for this beautiful house that I have, my beautiful wife, you know, the food that I eat every day, you know, nature, et cetera, et cetera. Just how grounding and how humbling just, you know, gratitude journaling and gratitude training is. So that's just like just another thing I would say that just it's got to be a must in the schedule.
Yeah, for sure. How long do you think we can get? Let's say with optimal mind, body performance, how long could a surgical career be?
You know, that's a great question. That's a really great question. Because there's, you know, I've, because of the certification in age management medicine and sort of winding up now, like indirectly helping so many people, literally thousands in something, physical, mental, spiritual, some eye surgeons, some that have nothing to do with surgery at all. And I've gotten to be friends with some of these quote unquote biohackers and all. They're completely convinced with like the genetic testing, the what's called epigenetic testing and showing how you're aging and DNA methylation, et cetera, et cetera. There's an answer to your question, I promise. But these people believe that the lifespan, you know, could be with a good health span, 150 to 200 years old. It's just insane. You know, when you think about, you know, in typical Western medicine, we still here in the United States, I think the average lifespan for a male is 75 and a woman is like 77. It really hasn't changed too much. You know, the biggest jump obviously came with vaccination, you know, childbirth, you know, those sorts of things. But, you know, it really hasn't budged too much. But a lot of these people who are feeling like, look, if you are doing these strategies with your diet and you're getting these tests, you know, looking at your blood vessels and, you know, and you're doing all these things right and sleep. So, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, I mean, if you really go to that extreme, you know, of taking care of yourself and all, I would venture to say, I mean, I know people, as I know you do, into their 70s doing it. So, gosh, you could probably be, if you were somebody who was really gung-ho and you wanted to keep doing that and you spent, all, you know, you were doing everything you could to stay in top shape, you probably could be in your 80s doing that. I don't know if I want to be doing it in my 80s. Yeah. I have one grandkid, two more on the way. Before next Christmas, I'll have three. So, you know, I do have some other aspirations, like, you know, getting to the top of Denali, you know, maybe Everest, you know, those kinds of things.
So maybe time to change gears later on.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I love what I do. Absolutely. And obviously, you know, we'll still be doing it for a while, you know, but, you know, and I think that's another part of being a complete person. It will help you be a complete surgeon, you know, having those other interests, you know, spending time with your family and your loved ones and, you know, whatever hobby it is, you know, having fun with it, because it just makes you more of a complete person. It makes you really appreciate and enjoy the work that you do.
Yeah. Early on, I made that mistake too. I made the mistake early on of like, I'm going to be so gung-ho. I'm going to be an absolute workaholic. I don't need to do anything else in my life other than work, 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 work. And then you don't realize until later that actually hinders your performance.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, someone was I was talking to, you know, the other day. I said, yeah, I said, if you had to, you know, just maybe pick one word, you know, to say, you know, what's the key to life, you know, kind of thing, I would have said, my first answer as a Christian would be God. Sure. And then if I had to have a secular word, I would say balance. You know, if you could find right the correct balance in your life, it's hard because, you know, as you have children, you know, spending time with your, you know, your loved ones, your kids, your hobbies, and then, you know, you're working 60 hours a week and you're doing hours and hours of cataractcoach.com and they're asking you to come to Malaysia to speak at a conference, et cetera, et cetera. It's hard, you know, and at certain times your balance is going to shift. You're going to be more into your work. Other times you're going to have to realize that and take some time, spend a little more time with your family. So it is shifting priorities, but I think it's, if you don't reflect on it, if you don't think on it, you know, then you're not going to achieve any sense of balance. So yeah, it's key. And I was like you, I think I've learned that a lot more now as I mature.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. We're still learning every day. That's the best part. And a lot of that learning, not just in the OR, not just surgical cases, but also learning about how to balance our own lives. That's no question.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
I'm far better now. Like, I've got my son's college graduation coming up next month. But yes, I'm still going to go fly to Iowa, give a lecture there, then go to his graduation, and then give another lecture in Tampa, and then head home. So it's somehow we balance it all out. It's going to be a busy time. But
that's right. No, well, you've always been one of my role models and continue to be.
Oh, you're too sweet. Thank you. No, I actually want to learn the whole mind, body, fitness. This podcast was mostly for me. I don't have thousands of ophthalmologists who listen to it, but it was mostly for me because this is an important topic to me. I didn't devote enough time to this in my 30s, even early 40s. And then now I just realize I really wish I'd gotten into this sooner. I think it makes a huge difference.
And, you know, one of the things I'll say to you and obviously any of the listeners, literally onboarding with a social media specialist is because I've been informed how deficient I am in my social media skills, you know. But anyway, obviously to be easily to be contacted through my email at wsocha@centerforsight.net. Anyone that wants to contact me and say, hey, I heard you say something about this red light or about breathing, or hey, I'm doing this as far as what I eat or what I take in my supplements or what I exercise, or hey, I was really interested in some of the stuff you said about spirituality. You know, it's like, I mean, I love those questions. So just
I'll put the email down here in the description so anyone can click on it and send you a link. And then I will try my best to convince you to start surgicalperformancecoach.com.
Yeah.
Or something simple. You have so much to share, and there's such a valuable amount of information here that we're frankly just never exposed to.
Right, right. No, there is. There's just so many ways, and people don't realize it. And, you know, it really is. There's a whole world out there of really, you know, getting yourself to peak performance, really, if there's, that's one way to put it, you know, in terms of your mind, your body, your spirit, the whole nine yards. And like I said, I think one really enhances the other. I mean, you know, how many, you know, spiritual gurus do you know that weigh 350 pounds? I mean, there probably are some out there. I mean, and I'm not, you know, and again, yeah. I feel bad for them if they are that way, but, you know, I think they probably would be that much better if they could feel better physically,
sure,
right?
Sure, sure, you know, sure, for sure.
Yeah, you know, and the same thing will wear down your mind. It's, you know, if your mind is always tired, you know, that's like, you know, well, maybe if I slept a little better, I ate a little better, my mind would be stronger and I could share that much more with others. So it really is a three-legged stool, no question about it.
Well, we'll try our best to achieve that. And in that regard, today is leg day for me. Don't skip leg day, right? Yeah. You see those guys in the gym?
That's hilarious. It's like we set this up or something, because that's what my wife and I did this morning. We were squatting heavy. And you know, one of the little hack too, and I'll let you
tell me,
just because we're talking about it.
Yeah, of course.
You know, in terms of physical fitness as we age. So there are there's something called blood flow restrictive training. You know, BFR, you'll actually see an acronym.
Yeah.
Yeah, and probably the most, probably the best. I don't know if there is anything that even competes with it out there on the market. Some of the Amazon and things, they'll try to almost like literally get tourniquets, and that could be bad. You know,
too thin,
et cetera. Yeah, there's a Japanese researcher by the name of Kayatsu, and he actually has a company. They're called Kayatsu Bands. I think it's Kaatsu. And so if you just Google that. And so anyway, these bands, I typically was using them because I do lift and all, like you put them around under your arm and in your legs. And it actually, like, you could pump it up and untether, and it comes in a consistent restriction, or it actually were kind of off and on. And so interestingly, like a lot of people who say, you know, I have this back problem or the shoulder problem and I can't do this and I can't do that. Like, even though I don't have a problem and I squat pretty heavy, like for me, because, you know, again, sort of built low to the ground and, you know, my thighs are about the size of my waist, you know, I can squat a lot, but I almost have to put on to do, like, we were doing like heavy sets of five or something. And so I have to put on about 275, you know, and doing a full depth squat, you know, to get enough heavy weight. And I can start feeling that, like, in my back and that sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So I dropped the weight and I put on the restriction bands. And so I'm getting the pump, if you will, like, it's doing 275 or 300 pounds, but I can have 205 pounds on while I'm doing it.
Less wear and tear on the body.
Yeah, and still get that pump. And so they've shown actually that people, even if they just walk around the house or maybe do some dumbbell exercises with 5 pounds or whatever, or do some air squats with those things on, that you increase your growth hormone, your brain-derived neurotrophic growth factor for, you know, for your mind, all these benefits that you can get from blood flow restrictive training. So again, the only reason I mentioned that on this, because again, a lot of people would say, well, this dude's crazy, you know, forget Socha, you know, but, you know, they want to do something, but, you know, you don't want to go the hardcore lifting route or this or that. There's a lot of ways you can skin the cat, if you will, and that's just a wonderful way to do it.
got one last lesson that's very important, because when you said 275, I was like trying to compare myself, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm such a wimp compared to Bill. But then I changed gear and I said, look, I'm only competing with myself.
That's right.
Not competing with someone else. I'm competing against me. Yeah. So for squats, I'm only doing, I do front squats. I don't like the bar behind me, so I put the bar on my shoulders in front of me.
Okay.
And for me, 185 is plenty. A plate and a quarter, that's plenty for me for the front squats.
That's great. And front squats are a lot harder than back squats. You actually have to have a better form in it, you know, to keep your back straight and have it racked properly and all. So that's great, man. That's it. And I'm glad you said that, because I know I think Joaquin was saying something last year about you talking about a bench press. And I think when we were together, you're the bench press. It's like, man, it's all about the legs.
No, for sure. So no, for sure. No, I don't skip leg day. Don't worry. Yeah, anyway, Bill, I want to thank you. What an incredible podcast. I learned so much. Again, I'll put some more info down below. People can contact you if they want. I do encourage you to set up some sort of website. You have such great material to offer. I'd be your first subscriber, I promise.
Well, you know, like I said, I'm slowly working on that. Interestingly, the gal who's helping me out with some social media stuff, her name is Alexa, you know.
See? I was like, meant to be.
Alexa or Siri or whatever. But anyway, so crazy stuff. But yeah, no, I've given thought to it, and I definitely want to share the knowledge that I have, and you know how much things, you know, all these things have helped me. I mean, and that's the biggest reason I think it's just great to have this opportunity. And I thank you so much, and I'm quite humbled, because I mean the people that you've had on here, I mean it's just like, I mean I pale in comparison to these folks in terms of the ophthalmology world, and they're my heroes. And you know, the fact that I've even just, you have me on here to talk about this stuff, it's just such a huge honor. So just thank you so much.
Of course. And the podcast right before you was Randy Olson, chairman of Utah.
So it was
amazing guy, an amazing man.
Yeah. Oh, I love him. I just saw him at ASCRS and we had a long talk. And Randy's fantastic. And he talk about the Energizer Bunny. The guy just keeps going. He's amazing.
Amazing stuff. Anyway, Bill, thank you again. And for my listeners, tune in next time. Next week, we're going to have another amazing podcast. Remember, now we're doing a new podcast every single week. And you know, I'll never miss a week. Wow, that was amazing. Thank you, Bill, for such great insight. And thank you guys for listening to our podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to it on Apple, Amazon, Google, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. You can listen audio only while you're, of course, working out, now you heard it here, or even driving to work. There are a lot of great pearls from this episode. I'm going to go do some Google homework right now and see if I can incorporate some of those into my life to make my life better, my surgeries better, and my physical fitness even higher. See you next time.